shrugs. With peach schnapps, Daisy reminds her.
Champagne, I repeat to the waitress, with, peach schnapps. Catch that?
Waitress nods, writes something down, leaves.
And I'm checking out her ass as she walks away. Then I look back at the three of them, studying each one very carefully for any signs, a flicker of betrayal that would cross their faces, the one gesture that would give away this robot act. But it's fairly dark in Nell's, and my hope that this is the case is just wishful thinking, and so I clap my hands together again and breathe in. So, it was really hot out today, right?
I need a new fur,
Libby sighs, staring into her champagne glass.
Full length or ankle length?
Daisy asks in the same toneless voice.
A stole?
Karen suggests.
Either a full length or...
Libby stops and thinks hard for a minute.
I saw this short, cuddly wrap. But mink, right?
Daisy asks.
Definitely mink?
Oh, yeah, mink, Libby says.
Hey, Taylor, I whisper, nudging him. Wake up. They're talking. You've got to see this.
But which kind?
Karen's on a roll.
Don't you find some minks are too fluffy?
Daisy asks.
Some minks are too fluffy,
Libby this time.
Silver fox is very popular,
Daisy murmurs.
Beige tones are also increasingly popular,
Libby says.
Which ones are those?
Someone asks.
Lynx, chinchilla, ermine, beaver.
Hello? Taylor wakes up, blinking. I'm here.
Go back to sleep, Taylor, I sigh.
Where's Mr. McDermott?
He asks, stretching.
Wandering around downstairs looking for Coke, I shrug.
Silver fox is very popular,
one of them says.
Raccoon, Fitch, squirrel, muskrat, Mongolian lamb.
Am I dreaming? Taylor asks me. Or am I really hearing an actual conversation?
Well, I suppose what passes for one. I wince.
Shh! Listen. It's inspiring. At the sushi restaurant tonight, McDermott, in a state of total frustration, asked the girls if they knew the names of any of the 9 planets. Libby and Karen guessed the moon. Daisy wasn't sure, but she actually guessed comet. Daisy thought that comet was a planet. Dumbfounded, McDermott, Taylor, and I all assured her that it was.
Well, it's easy to find a good fur now, Daisy says slowly, since more ready-to-wear designers have now entered the fur field. The range increases because each designer selects different pelts to give his collection an individual character.
It's all so scary, Karen says, shivering.
Don't be intimidated, Daisy says. Fur is only an accessory. Don't be intimidated by it.
But a luxurious accessory, Libby points out. I ask the table. Has anyone ever played around with a Tech 9mm Uzi? It's a gun. No? They're particularly useful because this model has a threaded barrel for attaching silencers and barrel extensions. I say this, nodding. Furs shouldn't be intimidating. Taylor looks over at me and blankly says, I'm gradually uncovering some startling information here.
But a luxurious accessory, Libby points out again.
The waitress reappears, setting the drinks down along with a bowl of grapefruit sorbet. Taylor looks at it and says, blinking, I didn't order this. Yes, you did, I tell him. In your sleep, you ordered this. You ordered this in your sleep.
No, I didn't, he says, unsure.
I'll eat it, I say. Just listen. I'm tapping my fingers against the table loudly.
Karl Lagerfeld, hands down,
Libby's saying.
Why?
Karen.
He created the Fendi collection, of course,
Daisy says, lighting a cigarette.
I like the Mongolian lamb mixed with mole, or,
Karen stops to giggle,
this black leather jacket lined with Persian lamb. What do you think of Jeffrey Bean?
Daisy asks her. Karen ponders this.
The white satin collars? Iffy. But he does marvelous things with Tibetan lambs,
Libby says.
Carolina Herrera?
Karen asks.
No, no, too fluffy,
Daisy says, shaking her head.
Too schoolgirl,
Libby agrees.
James Galanos has the most wonderful Russian lynx bellies, though, Daisy says. And don't forget Arnold Scassi, the white ermine, Libby says, to die for.
Really? I smile and lift my lips into a depraved grin. To die for?
To die for, Libby says again, affirmative about something for the first time all night. I think you'd look adorable in, oh, a Jeffrey Bean, Taylor. I whine in a high, faggy voice, flopping a limp wrist on his shoulder. But he's sleeping again, so it doesn't matter. I remove the hand with a sigh.
That's Miles.
Karen peers over at some aging gorilla in the next booth with a graying crew cut and an 11-year-old bimbo balanced on his lap. Libby turns around to make sure.
But I thought he was filming that Vietnam movie in Philadelphia.
No, the Philippines, Karen says. It wasn't in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah, Libby says then. Are you sure?
Yeah, in fact, it's over, Karen says in a tone that's completely undecided. She blinks. In fact, it's out. She blinks again. In fact, I think it came out last year.
The two of them are looking over at the next booth disinterestedly, but when they turn back to our table, their eyes falling on the sleeping Taylor, Karen turns to Libby and sighs,
Should we go over and say hello?
Libby nods slowly, her features quizzical in the candlelight, and stands up.
Excuse us.
They leave. Daisy stays, sips Karen's champagne. I imagine her naked, murdered, maggots burrowing, feasting on her stomach, tits blackened by cigarette burns. Libby eating this corpse out. Then I clear my throat.
So, it was really hot out today, wasn't it?
It was,
she agrees.
Ask me a question, I tell her, feeling suddenly, well, spontaneous.
She inhales on the cigarette, then blows out.
So, what do you do?
What do you think I do?
And frisky, too.
A model?
She shrugs.
An actor?
No, I say. Flattering, but no.
Well?
I'm into, murders and executions, mostly. It depends. I shrug.
Do you like it?
She asks, unfazed.
It depends.
Why? I take a bite of sorbet.
Well, most guys I know who work in mergers and acquisitions don't really like it, she says.
That's not what I said, I say, adding a forced smile, finishing my J&B. I'll forget it.
Ask me a question, she says.
Okay. Where do you... I stop for a moment, stuck. Then...
Summer?
Maine, she says. Ask me something else.
Where do you work out?
Private trainer, she says. How about you?
Exclusive, I say, on the Upper West Side.
Really?
She smiles, then notices someone behind me, but her expression doesn't change, and her voice remains flat.
Francesca. Oh my God, it's Francesca, look.
Daisy and Patrick, you devil!
Francesca screeches.
Daisy, what in God's name are you doing with a stud like Batman?
She overtakes the booth, sliding in with this bored blonde girl I don't recognize. Francesca is wearing a velvet dress by Saint Laurent Rive Gauche, and the girl I don't recognize is wearing a wool dress by Jeffrey Bean. Both are wearing pearls. Hello, Francesca, I say.
Daisy, oh my God, Ben and Jerry's here. I love Ben and Jerry,
I think is what she says, all in a breathless rush, shouting over the light din, actually drowning out the light din of the jazz band.
Don't you love Ben and Jerry?
She asks, her eyes wide, and then she rasps out to a passing waitress.
Orange juice! I need orange juice! Jesus fucking Christ, the help here has got to go. Where's Nell? I'll tell her.
She mutters, looking around the room, then turns to Daisy.
How's my face? Bateman, Ben and Jerry are here. Don't sit there like an idiot. Oh, God, I'm kidding. I adore Patrick, but come on, Batman. Look lively, you stud. Ben and Jerry are here.
She winks lasciviously, then wets both lips with her tongue. Francesca writes for Vanity Fair. But I already... I stop and look down at my sorbet, troubled. I already ordered this grapefruit sorbet. Gloomily, I point at the dish, confused. I don't want any ice cream.
For Christ's sakes, Bateman, Jagger is here. Mick. Jerry. You know...
Francesca says, talking to the booth but constantly scanning the room. Daisy's expression hasn't changed once all evening.
What a Y-U-P-P-I-E, she spells to the blonde girl.
Then Francesca's eyes land on my sorbet. I pull it toward me protectively. Oh, yeah, I say. Just another night with you. I sing, sort of. I know who he is.
You look thin, Daisy. You're making me sick.
Anyway, this is Allison Poole, who is also too thin and makes me sick. Francesca says, lightly slapping my hands, covering the sorbet, pulling the dish back toward her.
And this is Daisy Milton and Patrick. We've met,
Allison says, glaring at me. Hi, Allison. Pat Bateman, I say, holding out my hand.
We've met,
she says again, glaring harder. We have? I ask. Francesca screams.
God, look at that profile of Bateman's. Totally Roman. And those lashes! She shrieks.
Daisy smiles approvingly. I play it cool, ignoring them. I recognize Allison as a girl I did last spring while at the Kentucky Derby with Evelyn and her parents. I remember she screamed when I tried to push my entire arm, gloved and slathered with Vaseline, toothpaste, anything I could find, up into her vagina. She was drunk, wasted on coke, and I had tied her up with wire, slapped duct tape all over her mouth, her face, her breasts. Francesca has given me head before. I don't remember the place or when, but she's given me head and liked it. I suddenly remember, painfully, that I would have liked to see Allison bleed to death that afternoon last spring, but something stopped me. She was so high. Oh, my God, she kept moaning during those hours, blood bubbling out of her nose. She never wept. Maybe that was the problem. Maybe that was what saved her. I won a lot of money that weekend on a horse called Indecent Exposure. Well, hi. I smile weakly but soon regain my confidence. Allison would never have told anyone that story. Not a soul could have possibly heard about that lovely, horrible afternoon. I grin at her in the darkness of Nell's.
Yeah, I remember you. You were a real...
I pause, then growl. Manhandler. She says nothing, just looks at me like I'm the opposite of civilization or something.
Jesus, is Taylor sleeping or just dead?
Francesca asks while gobbling up what's left of my sorbet.
Oh, my God, did anyone read page 6 today? I was in it. So was Daisy, and Taffy, too.
Allison gets up without looking over at me.
I'm going to find Skip downstairs and dance.
She walks away. McDermott comes back and gives Allison, who's squeezing past him, the once-over before taking the seat next to mine. Any luck? I ask.
No dice,
he says, wiping his nose. He lifts my drink to his face and sniffs it, then takes a sip and lights one of Daisy's cigarettes. He looks back at me while lighting it and introduces himself to Francesca before looking back at me.
Don't look so, you know, astounded, Bateman. It happens.
I pause, staring at him before asking, Are you, like, shitting me, McDermott?
No, he says, no luck.
I pause again, then look down at my lap and sigh. Look, McDermott, I've pulled this act before. I know what you're doing.
I fucked her.
He sniffs again, pointing at some girl in one of the booths up front. McDermott's sweating profusely and reeks of Xerius.
You did? Wow.
Now listen to me, I say, then notice something out of the corner of my eye.
Francesca?
What? She looks up, a dribble of sorbet running down her chin.
You're eating my sorbet?
I point at the dish. She swallows, glaring at me.
Lighten up, Bateman.
What do you want from me, you gorgeous stud? An AIDS test? Oh my God, speaking of which, that guy over there, Kraft?
Yep.
No loss.
The guy Francesca pointed out is sitting in a booth near the stage where the jazz band plays. His hair is slicked back over a very boyish face, and he's wearing a suit with pleated trousers, and a silk shirt with light gray polka dots by Comme des Garçons Hommes, and sipping a martini. And it's not difficult to imagine him in someone's bedroom tonight, lying, probably to the girl he's sitting with. Blonde, big tits, wearing a metal-studded dress by Giorgio Di Sant'Angelo.
Should we tell her? Someone asks.
Oh, no, Daisy says. Don't. She looks like a real bitch.
Listen to me, McDermott. I lean in toward him.
You have drugs. I can see it in your eyes. Not to mention that fucking sniffing.
Nope. Negative. Not tonight, honey. He wags his head.
Applause for the jazz band. The whole table claps. Even Taylor, whom Francesca has inadvertently woken up. And I turn away from McDermott, heavily pissed, and bring my hands together like everyone else. Karen and Libby walk up to the table, and Libby says,
Karen's gotta go to Atlanta tomorrow. Vogue shoot. We have to leave.
Someone gets the check, and McDermott puts it on his gold Amex card, which conclusively proves that he's high on coke, since he's a famous tightwad. Outside it's muggy and there's a faint drizzle, almost like a mist. Lightning but no thunder. I trail McDermott, hoping to confront him, almost bumping into someone in a wheelchair, who I remember rolling up to the ropes when we first arrived, and the guy's still sitting there, wheels moving up, then backing away, up then back on the pavement, totally ignored by the doormen.
McDermott, I call. What are you doing? Give me your drugs.
He turns, facing me, and breaks into this weird jig, twirling around. Then just as abruptly he stops and walks over to a black woman and child who are sitting in the doorway of the closed deli next to Nell's, and predictably she's begging for food, a predictable cardboard sign at her feet. It's hard to tell if the kid, 6 or 7, is black or not, even if it's really hers, since the light outside Nell's is too bright, really unflattering, and tends to make everyone's skin look the same yellowish, washed-out color.
What are they doing? Libby says, staring, transfixed. Don't they know they need to stand closer to the ropes?
Libby, come on, Karen says, pulling her toward two taxis at the curb.
McDermott, I ask, what in the hell are you doing? McDermott's eyes are glazed over, and he's waving a dollar bill in front of the woman's face, and she starts sobbing, pathetically trying to grab at it. But of course, typically, he doesn't give it to her. Instead, he ignites the bill with matches from Canal Bar and relights the half-smoked cigar clenched between his straight white teeth. Probably caps, the jerk.
How gentrifying of you, McDermott, I tell him.
Daisy is leaning against a white Mercedes parked next to the curb. Another Mercedes, this one a limo, black, is double parked next to the white one. There's more lightning. An ambulance screams down 14th Street. McDermott walks by Daisy and kisses her hand before hopping in the second cab. I'm left standing in front of the crying black woman, Daisy staring.
Jesus, I mutter, then, here.
I hand the black woman a book of matches from Lutèce before realizing the mistake, then find a book of matches from Tavern on the Green and toss them at the kid and pluck the other matchbook from her dirty, scabbed fingers.
Jesus, I mutter again, walking over to Daisy. There are no more cabs, she says, hands on her hips.
Another flash of lightning causes her to jerk her head around, whining.
Where's the photographers? Who's taking the pictures?
Taxi!
I whistle, trying to wave down a passing cab. Another bolt of lightning rips across the sky from Zeckendorf Towers, and Daisy squeals.
Where is the photographer? Patrick, tell them to stop!
She's confused, her head moving left, right, behind, left, right. She lowers her sunglasses.
Oh my God, I mutter, my voice building to a shout. It's lightning, not a photographer, lightning.
Oh, right.
I'm supposed to believe you. You said Gorbachev was downstairs, she says accusingly. I don't believe you. I think the press is here. Jesus, here's a cab. Hey, taxi! I whistle at an oncoming cab that has turned off 8th Avenue, but someone taps my shoulder, and when I turn around, Bethany, a girl I dated at Harvard, and who I was subsequently dumped by, is standing in front of me, wearing a lace-embroidered sweater and viscose crepe trousers by Christian Lacroix, an open white umbrella in one hand. The cab I was trying to hail whizzes by. Bethany, I say, stunned.
Patrick,
she smiles.
Bethany,
I say again.
How are you, Patrick?
She asks.
I'm fine,
I stutter after an awkward bite of silence. And you?
Really well, thanks,
she says. You know, well, were you in there? I ask.
Yeah, I was, she nods then. It's good to see you.
Are you living here? I ask, gulping. In Manhattan?
Yes, she smiles. I'm working at Milbank Tweed.
Oh, well, great. I look back over at Daisy and I'm suddenly angry, remembering the lunch in Cambridge, at quarters, where Bethany, her arm in a sling, a faint bruise above her cheek, ended it all. Then, just as suddenly, I'm thinking, my hair. Oh, God, my hair. And I can feel the drizzle ruining it. Well, I gotta go.
You're at P&P, right?
She asks, then. You look great. Spotting another cab approaching, I back away. Yeah, well, you know.
Let's have lunch,
she calls out. What could be more fun? I say, unsure. The cab has noticed Daisy and stopped.
I'll call you,
she says. Whatever, I say. Some black guy has opened the cab door for Daisy, and she steps in daintily, and the black guy holds it open for me, too, while I get in, waving, nodding to Bethany.
A tip, mister?
The black guy asks.
From you and the pretty lady?
Yeah, I growl, trying to check my hair in the cab driver's rearview mirror. Here's a tip. Get a real job, you dumb fucking nigger. Then I slam the door myself and tell the cab driver to take us to the Upper West Side.
Didn't you think it was interesting in that movie tonight how they were spies but they weren't spies?
Daisy asks.
And you can drop her off in Harlem, I tell the driver.
I'm in my bathroom, shirtless, in front of the Ora Buena mirror, debating whether to take a shower and wash my hair since it looks shitty due to the rain. Tentatively, I smooth some mousse into it, then run a comb over the mousse. Daisy sits in the Louis Montoni brass and chrome chair by the futon, spooning macadamia brittle Haagen-Dazs ice cream into her mouth. She is wearing only a lace bra and a garter belt from Bloomingdale's.
You know, she calls out, my ex-boyfriend, Fiddler, at the party earlier tonight. He couldn't understand what I was doing there with a yuppie.
I'm not really listening, but while staring at my hair, I manage, oh, really?
He said, she laughs, he said you gave him bad vibes.
I sigh, then make a muscle. That's too bad. She shrugs and offhandedly admits,
he used to do a lot of cocaine. He used to beat me up.
I suddenly start paying attention until she says,
but he never touched my face.
I walk into the bedroom and start undressing.
You think I'm dumb, don't you?
She asks, staring at me, her legs tan and aerobicized, slung over one of the chair's arms. What? I slip my shoes off, then bend down to pick them up.
You think I'm dumb, she says. You think all models are dumb.
No, I say, trying to contain my laughter. I really don't.
You do, she insists. I can tell.
I think you are. I stand there, my voice trailing off.
Yes,
she's grinning, waiting.
I think you are totally brilliant and incredibly...
Brilliant, I say in monotone. That's nice. She smiles serenely, licking the spoon. You have, well, a tender quality about you.
Thanks. I take my pants off and fold them neatly, hanging them along with the shirt and tie over a black steel Philippe Stark clothes hanger. You know, the other day I caught my maid stealing a piece of bran toast from my wastebasket in the kitchen. Daisy takes this in, then asks, Why? I pause, staring at her flat, well-defined stomach. Her torso is completely tan and muscular, so is mine. Because, she said she was hungry. Daisy sighs and licks the spoon thoughtfully. You think my hair looks okay? I'm still standing there in just my Calvin Klein jockey shorts, hard on bulging, and a $50 pair of Armani socks.
Yeah, she shrugs. Sure.
I sit on the edge of the futon and peel off the socks. I beat up a girl today who was asking people on the street for money. I pause, then measure each of the following words carefully. She was young and seemed frightened and had a sign that explained she was lost in New York and had a child, though I didn't see it. And she needed money for food or something, for a bus ticket to Iowa. Iowa, I think it was Iowa, and I stop for a moment, balling the socks up, then unballing them. Daisy stares at me blankly for a minute before asking,
And then?
I pause, distracted, and then stand up. Before walking into the bathroom, I mutter, And then? I beat the living shit out of her. I open the medicine cabinet for a condom, and as I re-enter the bedroom, say, She had misspelled disabled. I mean, that's not the reason I did what I did, but, you know. I shrug. She was too ugly to rape. Daisy stands up, placing the spoon next to the Haagen-Dazs carton on the Gilbert Road-designed nightstand. I point. No. Put it in the carton.
Oh, sorry, she says.
She admires a Palazzetti vase while I slip on the condom. I get on top of her and we have sex, and lying beneath me she is only a shape, even with all the halogen lamps burning. Later we are lying on opposite sides of the bed. I touch her shoulder. I think you should go home, I say. She opens her eyes, scratches her neck. I think I might hurt you, I tell her. I don't think I can control myself. She looks over at me and shrugs.
Okay, sure.
Then she starts to get dressed.
I don't want to get too involved anyway, she says.
I think something bad is going to happen, I tell her. She pulls her panties on, then checks her hair in the Nebolev mirror and nods.
I understand.
After she's dressed, and minutes of pure hard silence have passed, I say, not unhopefully, You don't want to get hurt, do you? She buttons up the top of her dress and sighs without looking over at me.
That's why I'm leaving.
I say, I think I'm losing it.
Paul Owen. I screened calls all morning long in my apartment, taking none of them. Glaring tiredly at a cordless phone while sipping cup after cup of decaf herbal tea. Afterwards, I went to the gym, where I worked out for 2 hours. Then I had lunch at the health bar and could barely eat half of an endive with carrot dressing salad I ordered. I stopped at Barney's on my way back from an abandoned loft building I had rented a unit in somewhere around Hell's Kitchen. I had a facial. I played squash with Brewster Whipple at the Yale Club, and from there made reservations for 8 o'clock under the name Marcus Halberstam at Texarkana, where I'm going to meet Paul Owen for dinner. I choose Texarkana because I know that a lot of people I have dealings with are not going to be eating there tonight. Plus, I'm in the mood for their chili-wrapped pork and one or two Dixie beers. It's June and I'm wearing a 2-button linen suit, a cotton shirt, a silk tie, and leather wingtips, all by Armani. Outside Texarkana, a cheerful black bum motions for me, explaining that he's Bob Hope's younger brother,
No hope. He holds out a styrofoam coffee cup. I think this is funny, so I give him a quarter. I'm 20 minutes late. From an open window on 10th Street, I can hear the last strains of A Day in the Life by the Beatles. The bar in Texarkana is empty, and in the dining area only 4 or 5 tables have people at them. Owen is at a booth in the back, complaining bitterly to the waiter, grilling him, demanding to know the exact reason why they are out of the crawfish gumbo tonight. The waiter, a not bad-looking faggot, is at a loss and helplessly lisps an excuse. Owen is in no mood for pleasantries, but then neither am I. As I sit down, the waiter apologizes once more and then takes my drink order. J&B straight, I stress, and a Dixie beer. He smiles while writing this down. The bastard even bats his eyelashes. And when I'm about to warn him not to attempt small talk with me, Owen barks out his drink order. Double absolute martini. And the ferry splits.
This is really a beehive of, activity, Halberstam, Owen says, gesturing toward the near-empty room. This place is hot, very hot.
Listen, the mud soup and the charcoal arugula are outrageous here, I tell him.
Yeah, well, he grumbles, staring into his martini glass. You're late.
Hey, I'm a child of divorce. Give me a break, I say, shrugging, thinking, oh, Halberstam, you are an asshole. And then after I've studied the menu,
I see they've omitted the pork loin with lime jello.
Owen is wearing a double-breasted silk and linen suit, a cotton shirt and silk tie, all by Joseph Aboud, and his tan is impeccable. But he's out of it tonight, surprisingly untalkative, and his dourness drizzles over my jovial, expectant mood, dampening it considerably. And I have suddenly resorted to making comments such as, "Is that Ivana Trump over there?" Then laughing,
"Geez, Patrick, I mean, Marcus, what are you thinking? Why would Ivana be at Texarkana?"
But this doesn't make dinner any less monotonous. It doesn't help lessen the fact that Paul Owen is exactly my age, 27, or make this whole thing any less disconcerting to me. What I've mistaken at first for pomposity on Owen's part is actually just drunkenness. When I press for information about the Fisher account, he offers useless statistical data that I already knew about. How Rothschild was originally handling the account, how Owen came to acquire it. And though I had Jean gather this information for my files months ago, I keep nodding, pretending that this primitive info is revelatory, and saying things like, "This is enlightening," while at the same time telling him, "I'm utterly insane, and I like to dissect girls." Every time I attempt to steer the conversation back to the mysterious Fisher account, he infuriatingly changes the topic back to either tanning salons or brands of cigars or certain health clubs or the best places to jog in Manhattan, and he keeps guffawing, which I find totally upsetting. I'm drinking southern beer for the first part of the meal, pre-entree, post-appetizer, then switch to Diet Pepsi, midway through, since I need to stay slightly sober. I'm about to tell Owen that Cecilia, Marcus Halberstam's girlfriend, has 2 vaginas, and that we plan to wed next spring in East Hampton, but he interrupts.
"I'm feeling, slightly mellow," he admits, drunkenly squeezing a lime onto the table, completely missing his beer mug.
"Uh-huh." I dip a stick of jicama sparingly into a rhubarb mustard sauce, pretending to ignore him. He's so drunk by the time dinner is over that I, 1, make him pay the check, which comes to $250, 2, make him admit what a dumb son of a bitch he really is, and 3, get him back to my place, where he makes himself another drink. He actually opens a bottle of acacia I thought I had hidden, with a Mulazzoni sterling silver wine opener that Peter Radloff bought me after we completed the Heatherberg deal. In my bathroom, I take out the axe I'd stashed in the shower, pop 2 5-milligram Valium, washing them down with a tumbler full of plaques, and then I move into the foyer, where I put on a cheap raincoat I picked up at Brooks Brothers on Wednesday, and move toward Owen, who is bent over near the stereo system in the living room, looking through my CD collection. All the lights in the apartment on, the Venetian blinds closed. He straightens up and walks slowly backward, sipping from his wine glass, taking in the apartment, until he seats himself in a white aluminum folding chair I bought at the Conran's Memorial Day sale weeks ago, and finally he notices the newspapers. Copies of USA Today and W and the New York Times spread out beneath him, covering the floor to protect the polished white-stained oak from his blood. I move toward him with the axe in one hand, and with my other I button up the raincoat.
"Hey, Halberstam,"
he asks, managing to slur both words.
"Yes, Owen," I say, drawing near. "Why are there, copies of the style section all over the place?"
he asks tiredly.
"Do you have a dog? A chow or something?"
"No, Owen." I move slowly around the chair until I'm facing him, standing directly in his line of vision, and he's so drunk he can't even focus in on the axe. He doesn't even notice once I've raised it high above my head, or when I change my mind and lower it to my waist, almost holding it as if it's a baseball bat and I'm about to swing it at an oncoming ball, which happens to be Owen's head. Owen pauses, then says,
"Anyway, I used to hate Iggy Pop, but now that he's so commercial, I like him a lot better than..."
The axe hits him mid-sentence, straight in the face, its thick blade chopping sideways into his open mouth, shutting him up. Paul's eyes look up at me, then involuntarily roll back into his head, then back at me, and suddenly his hands are trying to grab at the handle, but the shock of the blow has sapped his strength. There's no blood at first, no sound either, except for the newspapers under Paul's kicking feet, rustling, tearing. Blood starts to slowly pour out of the sides of his mouth shortly after the first chop, and when I pull the axe out, almost yanking Owen out of the chair by his head, and strike him again in the face, splitting it open, his arms flailing at nothing, blood sprays out in twin brownish geysers, staining my raincoat. This is accompanied by a horrible, momentary hissing noise, actually coming from the wounds in Paul's skull, places where bone and flesh no longer connect. And this is followed by a rude farting noise caused by a section of his brain, which, due to pressure, forces itself out, pink and glistening, through the wounds in his face. He falls to the floor in agony, his face just gray and bloody, except for one of his eyes, which is blinking uncontrollably. His mouth is a twisted red-pink jumble of teeth and meat and jawbone. His tongue hangs out of an open gash on the side of his cheek, connected only by what looks like a thick purple string. I scream at him only once. "Fucking stupid bastard! Fucking bastard!" I stand there waiting, staring up at the crack above the onica that the superintendent hasn't fixed yet. It takes Paul 5 minutes to finally die, another 30 to stop bleeding. I take a cab to Owen's apartment on the Upper East Side, and on the ride across Central Park in the dead of this stifling June night in the back of the taxi, it hits me that I'm still wearing the bloody raincoat. At his apartment, I let myself in with the keys I took from the corpse's pocket, and once inside, I douse the coat with lighter fluid and burn it in the fireplace. The living room is very spare, minimalist. The walls are white, pigmented concrete, except for one wall, which is covered with a trendy, large-scale scientific drawing, and the wall facing Fifth Avenue has a long strip of faux cowhide paneling stretched across it. A black leather couch sits beneath it. I switch on the widescreen 31-inch Panasonic to Late Night with David Letterman, then move over to the answering machine to change Owen's message. While erasing the current one, Owen giving all the numbers he can be reached at, including the seaport, for God's sake, while Vivaldi's Four Seasons plays tastefully in the background, I wonder aloud where I should send Paul, and after a few minutes of intense debating decide, London. "I'll send the bastard to England," I cackle, while turning the volume down on the TV, and then I leave the new message. My voice sounds similar to Owen's, and to someone hearing it over the phone, probably identical. Tonight Letterman has on stupid pet tricks. A German shepherd, with a Mets cap on, peels and eats an orange. This is replayed twice in slow motion. Into a hand-constructed bridal leather suitcase, with a khaki-colored canvas cover, extra-heavy cap corners, gold straps and locks, by Ralph Lauren, I pack a wool six-button double-breasted peak-lapel chalk-striped suit, and one wool flannel navy suit,
both from Brooks Brothers, along with a Mitsubishi rechargeable electric shaver, a silver-plated shoehorn from Barney's, a Tag Heuer sports watch, a black leather Prada currency holder, a Sharp handy copier, a Sharp dial master, his passport in its own black leather passport case, and a Panasonic portable hairdryer. I also steal for myself a Toshiba portable compact disc player, with one of the discs from the original cast recording of Les Miserables still in it. The bathroom is done completely in white, except for the Dalmatian spot wallpaper covering one wall. I throw any toiletry articles I might have missed into a plastic hefty bag. Back at my apartment, his body is already in rigor mortis. And after wrapping it up in four cheap terry cloth towels I also bought at the Conran's Memorial Day sale, I place Owen head first and fully dressed into a Canalino goose down sleeping bag, which I zip up, then drag easily into the elevator, then through the lobby, past the night doorman, down the block, where briefly I run into Arthur Crystal and Kitty Martin, who've just had dinner at Café Luxembourg. Luckily, Kitty Martin is supposed to be dating Craig McDermott, who is in Houston for the night, so they don't linger, even though Crystal, the rude bastard, asks me what the general rules of wearing a white dinner jacket are. After answering him curtly, I hail a taxi, effortlessly manage to swing the sleeping bag into the back seat, hop in and give the driver the address in Hell's Kitchen. Once there, I carry the body up four flights of stairs until we're at the unit I own in the abandoned building, and I place Owen's body into an oversized porcelain tub, strip off his abood suit, and, after wetting the corpse down, pour two bags of lime over it. Later, around 2, in bed, I'm unable to sleep. Evelyn catches me on call waiting, while I'm listening to messages on 976 Twat and watching a tape on the VCR of this morning's Patty Winters show, which is about deformed people.
"Patrick?" Evelyn asks.
I pause, then in a dull monotone, calmly announce, "You have reached Patrick Bateman's number. He is unable to come to the phone right now, so please leave a message after the tone." I pause, then add, "Have a nice day." I pause again, praying to God that she bought it, before emitting a pitiful beep.
"Oh, stop it, Patrick," she says irritably. "I know it's you. What in God's name do you think you're doing?"
I hold the phone out in front of me, then drop it on the floor and bang it against the nightstand. I keep pressing some of the numbers down, hoping that when I lift the receiver up to my ear, I'll be greeted by a dial tone. "Hello? Hello?" I say. "Is anyone there? Yes?"
"Oh, for God's sake, stop it. Just stop it," Evelyn wails.
"Hi, Evelyn,"
I say cheerily, my face twisted into a grimace. "Where have you been tonight?" she asks. "I thought we were supposed to have dinner. I thought we had reservations at Raw Space."
"No, Evelyn," I sigh, suddenly very tired. "We didn't. Why would you think that?"
"I thought I had it written down," she whines. "I thought my secretary had written it down for me."
"Well, one of you was wrong," I say, rewinding the tape by remote control from my bed. "Raw Space? Jesus, you are insane."
"Honey," she pouts, "where were you tonight? I hope you didn't go to Raw Space without me."
"Oh my God," I moan. "I had to rent some videotapes. I mean, I had to return some videos."
"What else did you do?" she asks, still whining.
"Well, I ran into Arthur Crystal and Kitty Martin," I say. "They just had dinner at Café Luxembourg."
"Oh, really?"
Chillingly, her interest perks up.
"What was Kitty wearing?"
"An off-the-shoulder ball gown with velvet bodice and a floral-patterned lace skirt by Laura Marilacos, I think."
"And Arthur?"
"Same thing."
"Oh, Mr. Bateman," she giggles. "I adore your sense of humor."
"Listen, it's late. I'm tired." I fake a yawn.
"Did I wake you?" she asks worriedly. "I hope I didn't wake you."
"Yes," I say, "you did. But I took your call, so it's my fault, not yours."
"Dinner, honey, tomorrow?"
she asks, coyly expecting an affirmative response. "I can't. Work."
You practically own that damn company, she moans. What work? What work do you do? I don't understand.
Evelyn, I sigh, please.
Oh, Patrick, let's go away this summer, she says wistfully. Let's go to Edgartown or the Hamptons.
I'll do that, I say. Maybe I'll do that. Paul Smith. I'm standing in Paul Smith, talking to Nancy and Charles Hamilton and their 2-year-old daughter, Glenn. Charles is wearing a 4-button double-breasted linen suit by Radili, a cotton broadcloth shirt by Ascot Chang, a patterned silk tie by Eugenio Venanzi, and loafers by Brooks Brothers. Nancy is wearing a silk blouse with mother-of-pearl sequins and a silk chiffon skirt by Valentino, and silver earrings by Rina Pachocci. I'm wearing a 6-button double-breasted chalk-striped wool suit and patterned silk tie, both by Louis Boston, and a cotton Oxford cloth shirt by Luciano Barbera. Glenn is wearing silk Armani overalls and a tiny Mets cap. As the sales girl rings up Charles's purchases, I'm playing with the baby while Nancy holds her, offering Glenn my platinum American Express card, and she grabs at it excitedly, and I'm shaking my head, talking in a high-pitched baby voice, squeezing her chin, waving the card in front of her face, cooing, "Yes, I'm a total psychopathic murderer. Oh, yes, I am. I like to kill people. Oh, yes, I do, honey. Little sweetie pie, yes, I do." After the office today, I played squash with Ricky Hendricks, then had drinks with Stephen Jenkins at Flutie's, and I'm supposed to meet Bonnie Abbott for dinner at Poon Cakes, the new Bishop Sullivan restaurant in Gramercy Park, at 8 o'clock. The Patty Winters show this morning was about concentration camp survivors. I take out a Sony Watchman Pocket TV, the FD-270, that has a 2.7-inch black-and-white mini-screen, and weighs only 13 ounces, and hold it out to Glenn. Nancy asks,
"How's the shad row at Raffaelli's?"
Right now, outside this store, it's not dark yet, but it is getting there. "It's terrific," I murmur, staring happily at Glenn. Charles signs the slip, and while placing his gold American Express card back into his wallet, he turns to me and recognizes someone over my shoulder. "Hey, Lewis," Charles says, smiling. I turn around.
"Hi, Charles. Hi, Nancy."
Lewis Carruthers kisses Nancy's cheek, then shakes the baby's hand.
"Oh, hiya, Glenn. My, my, you look so big."
"Lewis, you know Robert Chance," Charles starts. "Pat Bateman," I say, putting the watchman back in my pocket. "Forget it, we've met."
"Oh, I'm sorry.
That's right, Pat Bateman," Charles says. Lewis is wearing a wool crepe suit, a cotton broadcloth shirt, and a silk tie, all by Ralph Lauren. Like me, like Charles, he wears his hair slicked back, and he's wearing Oliver Peoples redwood-framed glasses. Mine, at least, are non-prescription.
"Well, well," I say, shaking his hand. Lewis's grip is overly firm, yet horribly sensuous at the same time. "Excuse me, I have to purchase a tie." I wave bye-bye to baby Glenn once more, and move off to inspect the neckwear in the adjoining room, wiping my hand against a $200 bath towel that hangs on a marble rack. Soon enough, Lewis wanders over and leans against the tie drawer, pretending to examine the ties like I'm doing.
"What are you doing here?" he whispers.
"Buying a tie for my brother. It's his birthday soon. Excuse me." I move down the rack away from him.
"He must feel very lucky to have a brother like you," he says, sliding up next to me, grinning sincerely.
"Maybe, but I find him completely repellent," I say. "You might like him, though."
"Patrick, why won't you look at me?" Lewis asks, sounding anguished. "Look at me."
"Please, please leave me alone, Lewis," I say, my eyes closed, both fists clenched in anger.
"Come on, let's have a drink at Sophie's and talk about this," he suggests, starting to plead.
"Talk about what?" I ask incredulously, opening my eyes.
"Well, about us," he shrugs.
"Did you follow me in here?"
I ask.
Into where?
Here, Paul Smith.
Why?
Me? Follow you?
Oh, come on. He tries to laugh, scoffing at my remark. Jesus.
Lewis, I say, forcing myself to make eye contact.
Please leave me alone. Go away.
Patrick, he says, I love you very much. I hope you realize this. I moan, moving over to the shoes, smiling wanly at a salesperson. Lewis follows.
Patrick, what are we doing here?
Well, I'm trying to buy a tie for my brother, and I pick up a loafer, then sigh, and you're trying to give me head. Figure it out. Jesus, I'm getting out of here. I move back over to the tie rack, grab one without choosing, and take it up to the register. Lewis follows. Ignoring him, I hand the sales girl the platinum Amex card and tell her, there's a bum outside the door. I point out the window at the crying homeless man with the bag of newspapers standing on a bench next to the store's entrance. You should call the police or something. She nods thanks and runs my card through the computer. Lewis just stands there, shyly staring at the ground. I sign the receipt, take the bag, and inform the sales girl, pointing at Lewis, he's not with me. Outside, I try to wave down a cab on Fifth Avenue. Lewis hurries out of the store after me.
Patrick, we've got to talk, he calls out over the roar of traffic.
He runs up to me, grabbing my coat sleeve. I whirl around, my switchblade already open, and I jab it threateningly, warning Lewis to stay back. People move out of our way, continue walking.
Hey, whoa, Patrick, he says, holding his hands up, backing off. Patrick.
I hiss at him, still holding out the knife, until a cab I flag down skids to a stop. Lewis tries to get near me, his hands still up, and I keep the knife aimed at him, slicing the air with it. While I open the door to the cab, and back in, still hissing, then I close the door and tell the driver to head over to Gramercy Park, to Poon Cakes. Birthday. Brothers. I spend all day thinking about what kind of table my brother Sean and I will be seated at tonight in the Quilted Giraffe. Since it's his birthday and he happens to be in the city, my father's accountant, Charles Conroy, and the trustee of his estate, Nicholas Lee, both called last week and mutually suggested that it would be in everyone's best interest to use this date as an excuse to find out what Sean's doing with his life, and perhaps to ask a pertinent question or two. And though both of these men know I despise Sean, and that the feeling is unambiguously reciprocated, it would be a good idea to get him to come to dinner, and as a lure, as bait, in case he refuses, by mentioning not lightly that something bad has happened. I was on a conference call to Conroy and Lee last Wednesday afternoon.
Something bad?
Like what? I asked, trying to concentrate on the numbers sliding across my monitor while simultaneously waving Jean away, even though she was holding a sheaf of papers I was supposed to sign. That all Michelob breweries in the Northeast are closing? That 976 bimbo has stopped making house calls?
No, Charles said, then quietly mentioned. Tell him your mother is worse.
I mulled over this tactic, then said, he might not care.
Tell him,
Nicholas paused, then cleared his throat and rather delicately proposed,
it has to do with her estate.
I looked up from the monitor, lowering my Wayfarer aviator sunglasses, and stared at Jean, then lightly fingered the Zagat guide that sat next to the monitor. Pastels would be impossible. Ditto Dorsia. Last time I called Dorsia, someone had actually hung up on me, even before I asked,
well, if not next month, how about January?
And though I have vowed to get a reservation at Dorsia one day, if not during this calendar year, then at least before I'm 30, the energy I would spend attempting this feat isn't worth wasting on Sean. Besides, Dorsey is far too chic for him. I want to make him endure this dinner, to not be allowed the pleasure of being distracted by hard bodies on their way to Nell's. Somewhere with a men's room attendant, so he would have to be painfully subtle about what is now, I'm sure, his chronic cocaine usage. I handed the Zagat to Jean and asked her to find the most expensive restaurant in Manhattan.
She made a 9 o'clock reservation at the Quilted Giraffe.
Things are worse at Sandstone, I tell Sean later this afternoon, around 4 o'clock. He's staying in our father's suite at the Carlisle. MTV is blasting in the background. Other voices shout over its din. I can hear a shower running.
Like what? Mom ate her pillow? What?
I think we should have dinner, I say.
Dominique, cool it, he says, then places his hand over the phone and mutters something, muffled.
Hello, Sean?
What's going on? I'm asking.
I'll call back, he says, hanging up.
I happen to like the tie I bought Sean at Paul Smith last week, and I've decided not to give it to him. Though the idea of the asshole, say, hanging himself with it, pleases me greatly. In fact, I decide to wear it to the Quilted Giraffe tonight. Instead of the tie, I'm going to bring him a Casio QD150 quick dialer combination wristwatch calculator and data bank. It dials touch-tone phones sonically when held up to a mouthpiece, and it stores up to 50 names and numbers. I start laughing while putting this useless gift back into its box, thinking to myself that Sean doesn't even have 50 acquaintances. He couldn't even name 50 people. The Patty Winters show this morning was about salad bars. Sean calls at 5, from the Racquet Club, and tells me to meet him at Dorsia tonight. He just talked to Bryn, the owner, and reserved a table at 9. My mind is a mess. I don't know what to think or how to feel. The Patty Winters show this morning was about salad bars. Later, Dorsia, 9:30, Sean is half an hour late. The maitre d' refuses to seat me until my brother arrives. My worst fear a reality. A prime booth across from the bar sits there, empty, waiting for Sean to grace it with his presence. My rage is controlled, barely, by a Xanax and an Absolute on the rocks. While taking a piss in the men's room, I stare into a thin, web-like crack above the urinal's handle and think to myself that if I were to disappear into that crack, say somehow miniaturize and slip into it, the odds are good that no one would notice I was gone. No one would care. In fact, some, if they noticed my absence, might feel an odd, indefinable sense of relief. This is true. The world is better off with some people gone. Our lives are not all interconnected. That theory is a crock. Some people truly do not need to be here. In fact, one of them, my brother, Sean, is sitting in the booth he reserved when I come out of the men's room, after I've phoned the apartment and checked for messages. Evelyn's suicidal, Courtney wants to buy a chow, Lewis suggests dinner on Thursday. Sean is already chain-smoking, and I'm thinking to myself, damn, why didn't I request a table in the non-smoking section? He's shaking hands with the maitre d' as I walk over, but doesn't even bother to introduce us. I sit down and nod. Sean nods, too, having already ordered a bottle of Cristal, knowing that I'm paying. Also knowing, I'm sure, that I know he doesn't drink champagne. Sean, who is now 23, went to Europe last fall. Or at least this is what Charles Conroy said Sean told him, and though Charles did receive a substantial bill from the Plaza Athénée, the signature on the receipts didn't match Sean's, and no one really seemed to know how long Sean was actually in France, or even if he had spent real time there. Afterwards, he bummed around, then re-enrolled at Camden for about 3 weeks. Now he's in Manhattan before flying to either Palm Beach or New Orleans. Predictably, tonight, he's alternately moody and insistently arrogant. He has also, I've just noticed, started to pluck his eyebrows. He no longer has only one. The overwhelming urge I have to mention this to him is quelled only by squeezing my hand into a fist so tightly that I break the skin on the palm of my hand, and the biceps of my left arm bulges, then rips through the cloth of the linen Armani shirt I have on.
"So you like this place?" he asks, grinning.
"My favorite," I joke through clenched teeth.
"Let's order," he says, not looking at me, waving to a hard body who brings over 2 menus and a wine list while smiling appreciatively at Sean, who in turn ignores her totally.
I open the menu and, damn it, it's not prefix.
which means that Sean orders the lobster with caviar and peach ravioli as an appetizer, and the blackened lobster with strawberry sauce as an entree, the two most expensive items on the menu. I order the quail sashimi with grilled brioche and the baby softshell crabs with grape jelly. A hardbody opens the bottle of Cristal and pours it into crystal tumblers, which I guess is supposed to be cool. After she leaves, Sean notices me staring at him in a vaguely disapproving manner.
"What?" he asks.
"Nothing," I say.
"What is it, Patrick?"
He spaces the words out obnoxiously.
"Lobster to start with, and for an entree." "What do you want me to order? The Pringle potato chip appetizer? Two lobsters?" "These matchbooks are slightly larger than the lobster they serve here," he says. "Besides, I'm not that hungry."
Even more of a reason.
"I'll fax you an apology."
"Still, Sean."
"Rock and roll."
I know, rock and roll. Deal with it, right?" I say, holding up a hand while sipping the champagne. I wonder if it's not too late to ask one of the waitresses to bring a piece of cake over here with a candle in it, just to embarrass the shit out of him, to put the little bastard in his place. But instead I put the glass down and ask, "Listen, so..." "Oh, Jesus," I breathe in, then force out. "What did you do today?"
"Played squash with Richard Lindquist."
He shrugs contemptuously.
"Bought a tuxedo."
"Nicholas Lee and Charles Conroy want to know if you're going to the Hamptons this summer."
"Not if I can help it," he says, shrugging.
A blonde girl, close enough to physical perfection, with big tits and a Les Miserables playbill in one hand, wearing a long rayon matte jersey evening dress by Michael Kors from Bergdorf Goodman, Manolo Blahnik shoes and gold-plated chandelier earrings by Ricardo Saberno, stops by to say hello to Sean, and though I would fuck this girl, Sean ignores her flirtatious manner and refuses to introduce me. During this encounter, Sean is completely rude, yet the girl leaves smiling, raising a gloved hand.
"We'll be at Mortimer's. Later."
He nods, staring at my water glass, then waves down a waiter and orders a scotch, straight.
"Who was that?" I ask. "Some babe who went to Stevens."
"Where did you meet her?"
"Playing pool at MK," he shrugs.
"Is she a DuPont?" I ask.
"Why? Do you want her number?"
"No, I just wanted to know if she's a DuPont."
"She might be. I don't know."
He lights another cigarette, a Parliament, with what looks like an 18-carat gold cigarette lighter from Tiffany's.
"She might be a friend of one of the DuPonts."
I keep thinking of reasons why I'm sitting here right now, tonight, with Sean at Dorsia, but none come to mind. Just this infinitely recurring zero floats into view. After dinner, the food is small but very good. Sean touches nothing. I tell him that I have to meet Andrea Rothmere at Nell's, and if he wants espresso or dessert, he should order it now since I have to be downtown by midnight.
"Why rush?" he asks. "Nell's isn't that hip anymore."
"Well," I falter, quickly regain composure, "we're just going to meet there. We're really going to..." My mind races, lands on something. "Chernobyl." I take another sip of champagne from the tumbler.
"Big yawn. Really big yawn," he says, scanning the room.
"Or Contra Club East. I can't remember."
"Out. Stone Age. Prehistory," he laughs cynically.
Tense pause. "How would you know?"
"Rock and roll," he shrugs. "Deal with it."
"Well, Sean, where do you go?"
Immediate answer. "Petty's."
"Oh, yes," I murmur, having forgotten that it was already open. He whistles something, smokes a cigarette. "We're going to a party Donald Trump's having," I lie.
"Big fun. Very big fun."
Donald's a nice guy. You should meet him, I say. I'll introduce you to him.
Really?
Sean asks. Maybe hopefully. Maybe not.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, right. Now by the time I get the check, let's see, pay it, take a cab back to my place, it will be almost midnight, which doesn't give me enough time to return yesterday's videotapes. So if I don't stop by my place, I can just go in and rent another videotape. Though on my membership, doesn't it say that you can only take out 3 at a time? So this means last night I took out 2, body double and blonde hot dead. So I could rent one more, but I've forgotten I'm also part of the Gold Circle membership plan, which means that if I've spent $1,000, at least, in the last 6 months, then I'm allowed to rent as many videos on any given night as I want. But if I still have 2 out now, that might mean I can't take any more out, Gold Circle member or not, if the other ones haven't been returned, but... Damien. You're Damien, I think I hear Sean mutter.
What did you say?
I ask, looking up. I didn't hear you.
Nice tan, he sighs. I said nice tan.
Oh, I say, still confused about the video thing. I look down at what, my lap?
Thanks. Rock and roll.
He stamps his cigarette out. Fumes rise from the crystal ashtray, then die. Sean knows I know he can probably get us into Petty's, which is the new Norman Prager Club on 59th, but I'm not going to ask him, and he's not going to offer. I place my platinum American Express card over the check. Sean's eyes are glued to a hard body by the bar in a Thierry Mugler wool jersey dress and a Claude Montana scarf, sipping from a champagne tumbler. When our waitress comes by to pick up the check and the card, I shake my head no. Sean's eyes finally fall on it for a second, maybe more, and I wave the waitress back over and allow her to take it.
Lunch with Bethany. Today I'm meeting Bethany for lunch at Vanity's, the new Evan Kiley Bistro in Tribeca. And though I worked out for nearly 2 hours this morning, and even lifted weights in my office before noon, I'm still extremely nervous. The cause is hard to locate, but I've narrowed it down to one of 2 reasons. It's either that I'm afraid of rejection, though I can't understand why. She called me. She wants to see me. She wants to have lunch with me. She wants to fuck me again. Or, on the other hand, it could have something to do with this new Italian mousse I'm wearing, which, though it makes my hair look fuller and smells good, feels very sticky and uncomfortable. And it's something I could easily blame my nervousness on. So we wouldn't run out of things to talk about over lunch. I tried to read a trendy new short story collection called Walk that I bought at Barnes & Noble last night, and whose young author was recently profiled in the Fast Track section of New York Magazine. But every story started off with the line, "When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie," and I had to put this slim volume back into my bookshelf and drink a J&B on the rocks, followed by 2 Xanax to recover from the effort. To make up for this, before I fell asleep, I wrote Bethany a poem, and it took a long time, which surprised me, since I used to write her poems, long, dark ones, quite often, when we were both at Harvard before we broke up. God, I'm thinking to myself, as I walk into Vanity's only 15 minutes late, I hope she hasn't ended up with Robert Hall, that dumb asshole. I pass by a mirror hung over the bar as I'm led to our table and check out my reflection. The mousse looks good. The topic on the Patty Winters show this morning was, has Patrick Swayze become cynical or not? I have to stop moving as I near the table, following the maitre d'. This is all happening in slow motion. She isn't facing me and I can only catch the back of her neck, her brown hair pinned up into a bun. And when she turns to gaze out the window, I see only part of her profile, briefly. She looks just like a model. Bethany's wearing a silk gazar blouse and a silk satin skirt with crinoline. A Paloma Picasso hunter green suede and wrought iron handbag sits in front of her on the table, next to a bottle of San Pellegrino water. She checks her watch. The couple next to our table is smoking,
and after I lean in behind Bethany, surprising her, kissing her cheek, I coolly ask the maitre d' to reseat us in the non-smoking section. I'm suave but loud enough for the nicotine addicts to hear me and hopefully feel a slight twinge of embarrassment about their filthy habit. "Well?" I ask, standing there, arms crossed, tapping my foot impatiently.
"I'm afraid there is no non-smoking section, sir," the maitre d' informs me.
I stop tapping my foot and slowly scan the restaurant, the bistro, wondering how my hair really looks. And suddenly I wish I had switched mousses, because since I last saw my hair seconds ago, it feels different, as if its shape was somehow altered on the walk from bar to table.